Hello, and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. For this episode, our subject is silent screen icon Clara Bow. Bow was born in Brooklyn, New York in 1905, the product of a loveless marriage between her father, Robert, and mother, Sarah, the latter suffering from extreme bouts of mental illness. As a teenager, when Clara told her mother she wanted to be in motion pictures, her mother apparently replied, she would rather her daughter be dead. Despite this, Bow entered a nationwide acting contest whose previous winners often found work in movies. Against stiff competition and possessing no training, Bow won. She eventually got cast in the 1922 film Beyond the Rainbow. Bow recalls going to see the film with friends, only to learn that she was cut out entirely from the movie. Director Elmer Clifton cast Bow in the 1922 whaling drama Down to the Sea in Ships, and even though she was an unknown, critics singled her out as someone to watch. Bow moved to Hollywood in 1923 and was signed with Preferred Pictures, run by the imperious B.P. Schoelberg. Her popularity grew thanks to films like Black Oxen, Painted People, and Wine, her first starring role, followed by The Plastic Age, her biggest hit to that point. When Preferred folded, Schoelberg landed a position at Paramount, based partly on the fact that he had Bow under contract. She reached even greater heights there, starring in Dancing Mothers, Children of Divorce, Hula, and Wings, the first film to win a Best Picture Oscar. That same year, she starred in It, about a poor shop girl who captures the heart of her employer because she has the titular, to that point unnamed, quality. Forever after, Bow would be known as the It Girl. Like everyone else at the time, Bow was nervous about the move to sound films, worried her hard Brooklyn accent would turn her audience off. It didn't, and she racked up more box office successes like The Wild Party, Dangerous Curves, and The Saturday Night Kid, but she found she hated talking on screen. Adding to her stress was a series of personal crises related to her finances, her abusive and feckless father, who she brought out to Hollywood with her, and her personal assistant, who ended up on trial for trying to blackmail Bow thanks to a catastrophic chain of misunderstandings between her, Bow, and Bow's new husband, cowboy star Rex Bell. Schoelberg released her from her Paramount contract, and at the age of 25, she retired to live with Bell on a ranch in Las Vegas. She returned to Hollywood 1 year later with the sole purpose of making a few movies for the money with which she could retire permanently. She starred in 1932's Call Her Savage and then 1933's Hoopla. Bow returned to Las Vegas and never appeared in another film, despite numerous offers. She also turned down any and all interviews about her work. Separated but not divorced from Bell, she moved back to Los Angeles where she died in 1965. Joining me to discuss Hoopla and the career of Clara Bow is the tour guide at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery and the host of Hollywood Kitchen, Carrie Bible. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being here. This is really exciting. Before we talk about Clara Bow, and there is a lot to discuss, I learned so much researching this episode because I'll mention earlier, like my familiarity with Clara Bow was incredibly limited. I have to ask you, what is a tour guide at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery and how does one get that position?
Well, what part of the country are you in? I was curious about your accent.
I didn't even realize I have one. I'm in New Jersey. People that don't live in New Jersey say I have one, but of course I don't hear it, but I'm in New Jersey. Well,
I'm Southern. So if anyone's from like a Northern area, you can definitely hear it pretty quickly. I've been the in-house tour guide at Hollywood Forever since February of 2002.
Wow.
And how I got started, I majored in film. And when I was a little girl, okay, I'll take it back. When I was a little girl, I fell in love with classic Hollywood. My gateway drug was Bela Lugosi and the 1931 Dracula. And I just fell so much in love with movies. And also I fell in love with living history. My mom and dad liked the Civil War era a lot. And so they, on summer vacations, they would take me to Civil War battlefields and homes and cemeteries around the country. And you'd see the people so dedicated. They'd be riding around in the Union uniforms, Confederate uniform. I mean, it was hardcore, you know? And I remember just thinking like, this is like history brought to life. And it was pretty fascinating. So I kind of had this parallel love of history in general, and then also of classic film. And I never lost those passions. I got a degree in film from what at the time was called College of Santa Fe. And I moved to Los Angeles in the year 2000. And I saw the cemetery and just fell obviously in love with it, as I hope everybody does, whoever visits. And I asked around and there wasn't a tour guide. And I thought, well, maybe I could do it. So I met with a historian who is my mentor. I met with our owner of the cemetery and he gave me a green light. And I've been there since February of 2002. And I do a 2.5 hour walking tour. Sometimes it goes to three. I do those most Saturdays that I am in town. And I also do them by private appointment, occasionally at night. And that's just part of one of the many things that I do, but I love it. And for me, just the ultimate joy is being able to help history live on. You know, I've said the story many times, but if a year or two ago, this 20-year-old girl texted me after the tour and said, "My boyfriend and I are going to go home and watch Peter Lorre movies tonight. Can't wait."
Oh,
and I was like,
man.
That is why I got out of bed this morning. Thank you. That's why I bothered. So, because being able to share these people's lives, their careers, and that legacy is really kind of what motivates me.
So now, not only are you the tour guide at the Hollywood Cemetery, you are the only tour guide. You created the job.
I kind of did. But I think there are other people that also do. There's a company, Bikes and Hikes. I think they go through there. I know some independent tour guides who probably go through there. So it's not like I'm the only person ever, but I think I'm the only like in-house person, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's so. I that is so impressive because you saw an opportunity and you created one for yourself. I mean, that's fantastic. I've gone through my whole life doing things where I'm like, I don't want to bother that person. And then I don't do it. But you saw this thing and you jumped at it and it's worked out because you've been doing it for 20 years.
Yeah, 21. Well, I've kind of always been an oddball. And I always figured, even younger in my life, that if I was going to have opportunities, I would probably need to create a lot of them for myself.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've not really been a great fit for corporate America. Paying the bills is hard. So I've tried to kind of be entrepreneurial and create things for myself, you know? And so that's kind of been, I don't know, my attitude, I guess.
That's fantastic. All right. So I have to ask you a couple more things about this because fascinated by it. We will talk about Clara Bow, but I absolutely fascinated by this. So the tour that you take, are the people, I mean, you mentioned the young woman who was like, "Oh, I'm going to go watch Peter Lorre movies." Is it a diverse group of ages, or and the kind of people that are buried at the Hollywood Cemetery, are these lean towards, I would guess, older stars, younger people that have, you know?
I have a diverse age range. I mean, just last weekend, I had a couple in their 60s and then two 20-year-olds. So the age range is pretty diverse. It's a very famous cemetery. I mean, it's super world famous. But then also, I get a lot of diverse people that take it. And the tour that I do mainly focuses on the classic film stars. I do mention a few of the modern stars. I always kind of feel a little hesitant, though, because I don't want to be exploitative or inappropriate.
Sure.
You know what I mean? I'm very sensitive about things. So I do mention Anne Heche, and we stop there briefly. We do stop at Chris Cornell. We do stop at director Tony Scott. I mean, there are a few modern people we do visit, but I try to kind of keep it mainly focused on classic Hollywood. That's sort of the main, emphasis.
It's fascinating. I mean, like, I noticed you posted a picture today of you were at the grave of Estelle Getty, right? From the Golden Girls?
The other day marked her 100th.
Birthday. Right. And her headstone is massive. I mean, are there some celebrities that have these, you know, huge esplanades kind of thing? And are there others that have maybe, surprisingly like small little things?
Oh, yeah.
Like, wow, this person's huge and they just have this tiny little thing. And then there's someone else who has, you know, a tomb the size of like something for Lincoln.
Yeah, it's one of the convents I often get on the tour. Director John Huston's on it. And his grave is a little rectangle right under a giant shrub that seems to grow over that grave periodically. The lettering is all faded off. And for a long time, there was a crack in the side of it. And they fixed the crack. But every time I show people that grave on the tour, I always get, "Are you kidding? The guy's a 15-time Oscar nominee and that's it?" And I'm like, well, things are not what you'd expect in Hollywood ever. Nothing is. So I guess that kind of makes sense. But it's just you'd think someone like him would have some epic thing. And he totally doesn't.
That's really interesting. I have noticed as I've been reading books over the years about different celebrities or ones that the men that served in the military, a lot of them tend to go get buried in military cemeteries, not Hollywood ones, you know, like, and that seems to be like Lee Marvin's grave, as far as I understand, like literally just lists his service in the Marines. And if you didn't know who Lee Marvin was, you would never know he was a movie star.
Wow.
So I kind of find it interesting that some, like John Huston, we know Huston served, but he's in the Hollywood cemetery. I find that kind of interesting.
Yeah. Many years ago, I was doing a tour and I have a binder that I have photos in, you know, to show people. And I turned around while I was talking about him and Angelica was standing right there. I almost had a heart attack.
Oh my Lord.
Normally I consider myself a very articulate person. And I was like, I was like, I can't talk. Oh my God.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
It was a little odd. She was very nice, though.
Oh, that's good. Do people tend to ask you about the people more than the work? Or is it a mix of like, oh, well, this person did what? And then you're like, Peter Lorre was in this and this and this. And then they go, what you want from there?
What I do is I have this binder and I have a black and white headshot of them on one side of the page. And then I have a color printout of what I consider to be kind of their signature film.
Mm.
And that way it's a good way for people to go, oh, that guy. Okay. You know, because when I first started the tour, I just assumed everybody knew what all these people looked like. And I quickly figured out I was very wrong about that. So having the photo of them kind of connects it in people's minds, but also like for Peter Lorre, I have a poster of M in my binder. So I point to the poster, you can see his picture, and then people kind of can connect the dots from there. And it also helps when maybe if some people take my tour and they're not as strong with English, they can go, oh, okay. It kind of, you know, it helps as a visual aid, really.
That's fantastic. That's so inventive and so interesting. And like you're saying, you're helping keeping Hollywood history alive by these people that want to show up. Yeah, that's fascinating. So, okay. Well, on the flip side of that, kind of, what is the Hollywood kitchen? Because something involving food seems so being alive and sensory. It seems kind of almost like the opposite end of the spectrum of the Hollywood tour guide. So what is Hollywood kitchen?
This coming weekend, I'm actually going to be moderating a panel at Midsummer Scream, which is the largest Halloween and horror convention in the world. And the panel's about food, grief, and death. So I first made that connection when I was telling a friend that I can't eat a lot before I do a tour, like maybe a banana, maybe a granola bar and a little bit of water. And that's it. And it's not that I'm nervous because I pretty much know what I'm doing, but it's adrenaline. It's nervous energy, you know, but then the minute I'm done with the tour, I eat like a psycho and it's kind of sad. And a friend saw me do this one day and she laughed and she goes, you know why you do that, right? I said, I don't know. And she goes, because you've been around death half your day and now you need life. And I was like, oh my God, that makes so much sense. Like that was the first time I'd ever kind of made that connection. But during lockdown, like a lot of people, it was a brutally difficult time and a scary one. I love vintage cookbooks. I have been collecting them for ages from the teens up to about the 60s. And I have a lot of celebrity cookbooks and recipes. And I thought it would be fun to do something with them. I just hadn't quite gotten around to it, you know? And then when the lockdown happened, I thought, well, I do have a little more time than I thought I'd have. And I got the idea that maybe I could make the food of a different star for every episode attributed to them and then get either a fan, a historian, a collector, a friend, somebody online to talk to me. And the pandemic was in a weird way fortuitous for that because a few of the historians said, you know what? If you'd caught me any other time of the year, I would never have been able to say yes to this, but I have nothing going on. So let's talk about, you know, whatever Bela Lugosi liked to eat. So, I'd have people write me and go, you know, I know they didn't make all that stuff. And I said, well, I mean, we know for a fact, because I have firsthand confirmation that Marlene Dietrich cooked, Joan Crawford cooked, Vincent Price cooked. A lot of them, though, it's probably the work of a studio publicist, let's be honest. But for me, even if that is the case, it's a fun way to look into their lives. It's a fun and frankly humanizing window to look at who they were, both on screen and off screen and in their life. And So I'm having a great time with it. And I plan to keep going for it as long as I can. It's fun.
Yeah, that is super cool. I mean, of course, you know, like eating and death are two essential ingredients of everyone's life. So, I mean, they are connected that way, certainly. And you know, specifically with cooking, with the people you're talking about, Joan Crawford, Vincent Price, I mean, these are people of massive success who probably went through life with a large retinue of staff around them. So for them to cook, that had to be something they straight up wanted to do, because obviously generally they probably had people to do it for them. Most of us don't obviously go through life like that. We have to cook. Maybe we're not good at it, but we have to. But Joan Crawford, if Joan Crawford really liked cooking, that's because she really liked it, because otherwise she would have just had somebody make her meals for her 3 times a week, 7 days, you know, 3 times a day, 7 days a week.
She probably did have help in the kitchen if she wanted it, but I was able to get her grandson, Casey Lalonde. He's done 2 episodes with me, and he talks about eating in her apartment in New York when he was little. And wrote a whole lifestyle book called My Way of Life. So, you know, people think Gwyneth is like the lifestyle guru actress. It's like, well, long before Gwyneth, Gloria Swanson was, Crawford was, like, there's history of actresses kind of deciding that, you know what, they're going to be a lifestyle guru at a certain point in time. Vincent Price wrote like 3 cookbooks. I have all 3 of them, and he was a gourmet. Like, he was
such a Renaissance man, that guy.
Oh my God, I love him so darn much.
These people would have been great on Instagram nowadays. You imagine Vincent Price showing his Halloween themed meals every October. These would have been dynamite. Would have been fantastic. Right?
Sometimes when I'm stuck in LA traffic and I really, my mind wanders, sometimes I'll think, like, what would Errol Flynn have done if camera phones had existed in the 40s?
Oh, Lord.
You know, like, can you imagine? Like, the trouble some of these people would have gotten into had they not had a studio publicist, like, reining them in somehow.
Woo, yeah.
Mind boggles at such things.
It sure does. Well, that's actually a wonderful segue to who we're here to talk about, Clara Bow. Generally on this show, I read, if there's a biography of them, I read it, because I just figure, you know, aside from watching the films, it's good background material. But I try and, as best I can, leave that stuff out, because the show is about their work. It's not about the personal life. That said, I read the one book that I was able to find about Clara Bow, which is Running Wild. David Sten.
Excellent book.
And I mean, boy, howdy, the first couple of chapters, it is so unbelievably dark, her beginnings, which I, you know, hinted at a little bit in the intro, that it, you can't help but feel like it informs the career and the fact that she was at 25 retired after being the biggest star in the world at 25, packed it in. So, I mean, we're going to talk about all that, but I'm fascinated. Why did you want to talk about Clara Bow? Anybody we could discuss, why her?
Well, I love silent film. I just got back actually from the San Francisco Silent Film Festival. I love silence. And Clara, when I very first saw her in film, I saw Wings. That was the first one of her films I saw. And I was just fascinated. She just is a mega watt presence on screen. Like, you don't pay attention to hardly anything or anybody else but her when she's in a scene.
Yep.
And I wanted to learn more about her. So I got Running Wild and just read that book like in probably one sitting, because it's so good. And then I sought out to see as many of her films as I could. I've been pretty lucky because I've gotten to see a lot of those on the big screen. I saw a few of them at Film Forum in New York City. I've seen a lot of them at the UCLA Archive here in Los Angeles. And Clara is just a fascinating person. And when you talk about how you normally don't talk about their personal lives, to me, that's such a hard thing, because a lot of times the personal life fuels the work and the image.
Yeah.
And it's almost hard to separate that out, because that could apply to a lot of different stars, like who they were in their private lives and the things that happened to them and how that showed up on film. You know, so it's very hard, if not impossible, to kind of make that separation.
Yeah, absolutely. I will say, for many, many years, when I was like a kid and then a teenager, the single reference I had ever known about Clara Bow was on an episode of MASH, of all things. I mean, everyone knows I do a podcast about that show. And there's an episode where Hawkeye and Colonel Potter are out kind of out in the Korean hinterland, and they come, they get shot at, and then these Chinese soldiers leave, and then these American soldiers show up, and they pop out of this ditch, and they have to, you know, acknowledge, we're, don't, and Potter says, don't you, we're Americans. And Hawkeye says, Betty Grable, apple pie. And Colonel Potter goes, Clara Bow. And Hawkeye goes, Clara Bow, you are old. And that was the whole theme of the episode. Aww. Is that Colonel Potter was feeling his age. So for years, that was the only reference I knew of Clara Bow. That was, I didn't know, I knew she was an actress, and it was old. That's all that I meant. That's all I knew. And then when I finally started working at a video store in the 90s, I still hadn't seen any of her films, but I was like, oh, that's who this is. Cause we had a silence section, and I was like, oh, okay. She's this. Oh, okay. I understand. Oh, she's the It Girl. Oh, okay. And then I started getting her. And then, so I finally saw one of her films, which was Wings, which is a, you know, masterpiece of a film. It's funny though, now that I've seen a bunch of her films where she's the star, Wings is like not something you would think. If someone said, give me some great Clara Bow films, that would not be one I would show, because she's sort of side to the main action, really. She's not the star of it. I mean, and I went and watched a bunch of films. I guess we watched Hoopla, her final film, again, which we're going to talk about. But I watched The Saturday Night Kid. I watched It. Certainly, I had to watch It. Children of Divorce and Down to the Sea and Ships. Those are the ones I managed to catch. A lot of them are very hard to find. I wanted to watch The Wild Party because it's a famous book, a famous poem, and it's got Friedrich March in it, who I love, but I just was not able to find that anywhere. But one of the things I did notice watching these films is, like you mentioned, when she is on the screen, it is, you just look at her. And it's amazing that she came through that film, the It. I mean, the film's named It. That's what it was. It's this indefinable thing where your eyes are immediately drawn to her. And when you think about the fact, and I didn't know any of this until I read the book, she had no formal training.
No.
She came from a completely like I said, her mother said, I'd rather you be dead than in the movies. Because of course, back then, Hollywood meant, you know, Fatty Arbuckle and all those scandals and things like that. It was considered like this really low art full of really seedy people. But she came from absolutely no support system, no skill, and yet the minute you see her, even in Down to the Sea and Ships, you're like, yeah, that's bang, that's who it is. And it's amazing.
Oh, it really is. And she just had this natural charisma, this God-given talent. I don't know another word for it, because yeah, it's not like she had all this theater training or schooling or anything like that. And she was just so intuitive, and she was so emotional too. I mean, she could just turn on the tears. I mean, she was really a remarkable actress.
And it's, again, considering she had no training, none.
Yeah.
She just was able to do this.
I think maybe her training might have been just watching movies, because I know David Sten, and I've seen him talk and speak about her at different events. And, you know, he talks about how she was one of the first generations actually raised on movies. Because if you think about it, you know, movies started in America in the early 1900s, 1903, around that time, you know, and Clara grew up seeing Mary Pickford, grew up seeing those stars from the teens. And so she probably would have just gone home, made faces in the mirror, mimicked what she saw on film. You know, I mean, so that might have very well been her training.
I think part of the theory, too, and that why she became so popular, and David Sten gets into this in his book, is that she sort of exemplified the modern 1920s woman, is that women were getting opportunities. It's like you talked about, like Amelia Earhart, or, you know, like women were getting to do things that they were not previously able to do. And she exemplified that, because, like you said, when she shows up in these movies, she is like this firecracker. I think about, there's a scene in It where she's talking to her boss and they're having this dialogue scene, and she lays on his desk.
Yeah.
And it's not, it isn't related to the action. To the dialogue. It isn't related to anything she's saying, where she's like, hey, I'm going to, like, she just does it. Like, it's this you're like, first of all, it's like very sexy, because you're like, she's being so sort of kittenish laying there, and she's trying to kind of get him riled up there. But you feel like most actors with any training would not have done that. But she just does it, and she's sort of kicking her legs, and you're like, you kind of feel bad for that actor, the other actor in the scene, because you're like, nobody's paying attention to what you're saying. You know, you're just like, oh, just wait for you to be done talking so Clara Bow can go again.
Well, and the thing about Clara Bow, too, I think that she was unapologetic about sex. Because in America, this is a time when, you know, you did not talk about that in polite company. And in the case of Clara, like before Clara, you had Theda Bara and maybe you had the vamps and everything. But with the vamps, there was always a lot of times anyway, this sense that they were these evil vampires that were sucking the, you know, the vital fluids out of men, et cetera. And also that there was some sort of comeuppance. There was some sort of punishment. There was, you know what I mean?
Oh, sure.
And Clara, she kind of, I saw one quote somewhere that said Clara brought sex into America's backyard. And like, wow. You wouldn't have seen a female star. There's a line in it where she goes, "Sweet Santa, give me him." She was aggressive about going after men and pursuing men, zero apologies. And in an era where that wasn't done. Because again, the vamp, that was kind of a whole different thing. Do you know what I mean by that? That was kind of a whole different archetype. But what Clara Bow did was really kind of flip the script, if you will, of the courtship and dating rituals. And I think probably, can you imagine if all the women going to the movies, probably never seen a woman that aggressive before, that knowing exactly what they want and going after it before? That had to have been kind of a revelation at the time. And Clara Bow, another quote I read about her somewhere, it said she was a one-woman sexual revolution. And that is so true, because not only on screen, but she dated like a lot of different men. Was
Gary Cooper, open. Victor Fleming, and all these,
Gilbert Roland. She was Gilbert Roland, and discussing said men, and she just no apologies there, you know. And this was a time where a lot of stars hid their backgrounds or hid, you know, a lot of things about their life, and Clara was kind of the opposite. Like she almost enjoyed seeming to kind of shock people. Like there's a story in the book where she comes up to Esther Ralston on the set of Children of Divorce. And she's like, "Esther, do you like Gary?" And Esther Ralston says, "Yeah, I think he's nice." And she goes, "Me too. Plus, he lets me take my dogs in the bathtub when he bathes me every morning." Say that kind of stuff in 1927, right? No, that was not done. So the fact that Clara was that open about it was just kind of revolutionary, really.
And I have to figure that because she got so famous as herself in the tabloids, by the way, we think nowadays, like the, you know, the media gets a little invasive. Boy, howdy, compared to what it was in the 20s. I mean, some of the stuff said about stars back then is stunning. And again, we'll talk a little bit briefly about when the press turned on her, because that's always the way it happens. They build you up and then they tear you down. And some of the stuff said about her is just staggering in its viciousness. And, you know, if you go and you look her up on YouTube, you'll find videos about some of those controversies to this day. So we're talking 2023, and there's a video about, did Clara Bow really have sex with an entire football team? You're like, wow, that's still a thing. Somebody's making a video about that in the 21st century.
She didn't, by the way, but
she did not. But I mean, that rumor is still worthy to someone of discussing, you know, a full 100 years after she was famous. But I have to figure that this thing of like her public persona and her star persona are merging into one thing. And that's why she became so popular, because you're kind of rooting for her. Because as you were saying, like Theda Bara is the vamp. She's never the vamp in any of these movies. She's always wants to be in love. She's you know, kind of mistreated by society or whatever. But you're rooting for her in almost all of her films.
Yeah. And like the vamp character, you really didn't root for him so much as you're like, oh boy, that guy's life's going to be ruined. He just met, the vamp. But yeah, in Clara's case, you like her. You identify with her. She wasn't this exotic vamp. She was the girl next door who just happened to be real upfront about what she wanted and who she wanted. I think Clara is such a forerunner for so many stars and shows that have come after.
Completely. It's funny. Right around the same time I was doing research for this episode, I happened to watch a Spanish film from 1973 called Spirit of the Beehive. We were watching something on Criterion, and Guillermo del Toro mentions it as one of his favorite films. And there, that's a film that stars a child actor. And he mentions that the main actor, it's a young girl who's probably like 8 in the movie. He says, she looks right through you. And you watch that film and she does. You're like, oh, there's something about this kid is seeing something that everyone else is acting and they're acting well. But this kid is like seeing other dimensions and you can see it when he mentioned it. You're like, wow. And I just happened to watch that film around the same time I was watching the Claire Beau stuff. And I felt the same way about her where you're like, yeah, she is seeing something. Not to diminish the other actors that she's with, but she's seeing something. It feels like she's taking something in grander than just the paces of the story she's being put through, because at least for the ones I watch, a lot of them were the same beats. You know, it was kind of the same. Okay, she's kind of the shop girl who's poor, and even though for most of her films you can't hear her, it's the idea that, you know, she comes from kind of the wrong side of the tracks or whatever, and she's trying to make her way up. There were a lot of similar things to it, but there's something about, like, even in these sort of shopworn plots, in some cases she's bigger than the films that she's in, if that makes any sense.
Oh, absolutely. And one thing I've heard some directors say is that sometimes they like working with child actors who were not trained, because, you know, sometimes in classic movies, you can see a child actor and they look like a little poodle going through their bag of tricks.
Yeah.
What I mean, they're trained, they're highly trained with all these tricks and all these expressions and all these little things. And like sometimes when you get a very intuitive child performer, they haven't learned all of those things. So they're stripped bare of those kind of mannerisms or cutesy cloying type of things. And they're just a raw, pure talent, if that makes any sense.
No, completely. Completely.
You know, and I think there are some children actors that are not at all trained that have that. And I think Clara Bow had that too.
Yeah. Do you have of her films, of the ones you've seen? I mean, do you have a particular favorites? Either the film itself is just really good, or her favorite performance by her?
Well, I think It is definitely like one of the best ones. I would say that's like her signature film, but it's hard to say because here's the problem as I see it. And of course it was in the book too, is they just thought seeing Clara on screen is enough for audiences. It doesn't have to be a good film. We'll pay to see her in anything. So like they would crank out so many of these movies that were not very good. And she wanted better material, but I don't think she had the wherewithal or maybe the self-confidence to go, no, this script sucks. I deserve better. I don't think she had that. And I've seen some of these films that they'll have really good sequences or really good parts, but the whole film isn't that good, but she's the best thing in it. And at one point, this is in the book, of course, David O. Selznick wrote a letter or memo saying, look, Clara Bow's at a time in her career when only a great role will save her. She needs great material. And the studio just didn't care. I think that she was kind of treated by Hollywood and a lot of the people in Hollywood as sort of a second-class citizen or trashy, and they just didn't really respect her as an artist, and they just didn't treat her like she should have been treated.
Yeah, one of the things that I wrote down when I was preparing my notes was, it's so depressing in that this is such it's an early example of a star who comes out of nowhere, shows up to Hollywood, makes the producers for Hollywood, makes the studio a fortune, and then the Hollywood system just chews them up and spits them out. And, you know, we're talking, you know, this is 100 years ago at this point, and we're still going through that. These stars still do it. You know, you can see a lot of stars, the minute they get huge, they just start making garbage. And you kind of say, why doesn't anybody see through this? Why can't you figure out that if you have somebody that's popular, the minute you just start slamming them and stuff, that's going to start diminishing their popularity, and then they won't be worth anything anymore. And it was so depressing to see that, yeah, this was happening 100 years ago. It's still happening now. Nobody's learned anything in a century of making movies. It's the same. And again, the level of the way Bud Schoenberg treated her when they said at one point she was making $15,000 a week in 1920s money. I mean, it's staggering. And yet they just put her in a bunch. I mean, they said at one point she did 6, 7, 8 movies a year. I mean, it just, I mean, I know back then things ran a lot less and there was, you know, movies were cycled through a lot faster. It's not like nowadays, but still, like, yeah, she just didn't have the ability, as you say, probably the confidence to kind of say, wait a minute, I need better material. And that leads into something. One more thing I want to discuss before we talk about the final film, which is Hoopla, is I think, and I'm interested if you agree with me on this, an example of someone who I think is not falling into that trap as in terms of modern star is Margot Robbie, who in Babylon is playing essentially a Clara Bow, is not playing Clara Bow, but she's Clara Bow in terms of the character she's playing. I mean, she plays someone from kind of a hardscrabble background. She's got relatives that live in a like a mental institution, which Clara Bow had. There's even the joke about she shows up to a pool party with a football team.
I didn't see
her.
Babylon. I do. I need to preface to you this.
Okay.
I love the silent era so much, and I also collect vintage clothing, and it I just couldn't, based on what I saw, I'm like, this is going to drive me nuts.
she's playing a Clara, again, she's not playing Clara Bow. She's yeah, playing a Clara Bow type. Clearly it's what's driven. It's derived from that. But I feel like that's she seems like someone, a modern example, who I guess for understand is running a production. She has her own production company, is not allowing herself to be thrown into the Hollywood and is sort of directing her own career in a way that is, I think she's maybe looking towards the long game, you know, like she wants to be around a long time and work with interesting people and work with interesting directors. I mean, she's working with Quentin Tarantino and Damon Chazelle. And now she's with Greta Gerwig doing the hugest hit, you know, any woman director's ever had in Barbie. And I just find it interesting that maybe someone like Margot Robbie has looked back at some of these people. There's, you know, hundreds of examples leading up to her and saying, I got to do something a little different because I don't want to end up the way a lot of these people do, where they get chewed up and spit out by the Hollywood system.
Well, this town is tough. And no matter who you are, what you have, it's a very, very tough industry. And I think a lot of there were women that had their own production companies back then, like Mary Pickford, that were very powerful. But it was, I'm sure, a lot harder, you know, at the time to be taken seriously as a female producer, as a female screenwriter or director or whatever. And I think that Margot's smart. I really respect her. I think she's very savvy and she's kind of been able to really take the reins of a lot of things in her career. I don't know that it's hard to say, but I don't know that there were as many women that had as much power or could have, you know, I mean, it's hard to say, but unfortunately Clara didn't. I mean, she just didn't have, and I don't think Clara was a business person either. Like Mary Pickford was someone that her business mind was every bit as strong as her creative mind, you know? And a lot of stars aren't that. They're just these artistic people that just, they just want to work and make movies and someone else pay the bills. Someone else figure out all that other stuff, you know? And it's very rare when you see someone that's like a brilliant business and creativity. Douglas Fairbanks was, Mary Pickford was, but that's not the most common thing. Do you know what I mean?
Oh yeah. It's usually left brain or right brain kind of thing.
Yeah. Not like even Gloria Swanson, she had her own production company. She was producing movies, but she wound up trusting a lot of her finances to Joseph P. Kennedy, who screwed her over. And you know, so it's like, it's really hard. It's not a lot of people are able to really excel in both of those things. And Clara, she was an intuitive, creative talent, but she couldn't manage money. She wasn't a business person. That just wasn't who she was, you know?
She kept investing in her father's businesses and he failed one business. I mean, aside from the fact that he was a sadist and he sexually abused his own daughter, she brings him out to Hollywood and then just keeps funding his businesses, including an It Girl restaurant, which fails in a year. I mean, she's just throwing money at him and he just keeps losing it. And at one point she ends up kind of broke and you're like, wait a minute, she's made $15,000 a week. How is that possible to burn through that much money? It's like, well, yeah, you mismanage it long enough, that's going to happen.
Yeah. And also, you know, as I think when someone is very wealthy and successful, everybody's got their hand out. Hey, I need rent money. Hey, I need money for this. Hey. And if they're generous in nature, they're just going to do that, which she was. And again, they're not keeping an eye on the bottom line. They're not worrying about what it's going to look like in the checking account. They just do it. And, you know, I think Clara's attitude might have been, it's better to have one parent who is, even though they're a sexually abusing monster, than have no parent at all. because her parents' mother died in a mental institution right when she was rising to stardom. So I think even as horrible as the dad was, I think it was better than nothing, I guess, in her mind, maybe.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. Speaking of her management, her money management, is good. She finally falls in love with this cowboy actor, Rex Bell, and she is tired of the Hollywood grind, and he wants to live, he wants to move out to Las Vegas and run a ranch. And so she straight up retires. She says, that's it. I'm done at 25. She's released from her contract and she leaves Hollywood to go live in Las Vegas. And then she realizes, well, I need a little more money. So, and she sees that she's missed. Just in this short period of time, people are like, where are the Clara Bow movies? And so she makes this kind of very clear eyed decision to say, I'm going to do a couple more movies for the money, I'm going to bank the money, and then I'm going to live off that. That is what I'm going to do, because that's how much money I can make off these movies. And she does two more films, which again is, for someone who clearly didn't manage money really well, it's kind of amazing. She was able to kind of be like, hey, no, this is what I'm going to do. I'm just going to do this, take this, and go. And so she does the Call Me Savage that I mentioned, and then Hoopla, which I mentioned is her final film. It was released on November 30th, 1933. I'm going to just briefly go into the plot and the cast so people know what kind of film we're talking about. You can find this movie, by the way, on YouTube. The entire thing is on YouTube, like a lot of her silent films, although this is a talkie. So when the sheltered son of the owner of a traveling circus shows up unexpectedly, his father, named Nifty Miller, wants to send him back to school and keep him away from circus folk. But the son stays anyway to work at the circus, leading Nifty to want to cool it with his mistress, Carrie. Carrie, in a fit of anger, hires a dancer named Lou, Clara Bow, to seduce the young man and lure him away from his father. Lou comes to realize that the young man, Chris, is a good guy, and they genuinely fall in love and get married. Nifty throws them out of the circus, and they struggle to make it on their own in Chicago. Lou continues dancing to help put Chris through law school while simultaneously trying to patch things up between her husband and father-in-law. Clara Bow plays Lou. Nifty is played by Preston Foster. Chris is played by Richard Cromwell. Hap is Herbert Munden. We'll get into their credits a little bit. There's a character named Jerry, played by James Gleason. Mina Gumbo is also in the film, Roger Imhoff, and it's directed by Frank Lloyd, who also directed Clara in Children of Divorce. He also did movies like Mutiny on the Bounty, Cavalcade, and The Last Command. So what do you think of this as a Clara Bow movie? Not necessarily like, does it work as her final, as her sort of on-screen goodbye, but what do you think of it as just one of her movies?
No, I do think of it as her goodbye, because I think that a lot of silent stars, even some of the ones who could have stayed around and sound longer, I think their heart just wasn't in it anymore. They kind of lost the love, you know? And because silent film was a very different way of making movies. As I've seen people describe it, the set was kind of like a little cocoon. You had the musicians on the set playing music. You had maybe the director right off camera kind of talking you through a scene or guiding you. And sound required a whole other system of operating. You had all different sound stages built. They couldn't be like the ones in the silent era because they had to be soundproof. And you had to, the movement was a little more constricted. You know, you weren't quite as free, especially in the early years of that. And it was just, the crew had to be super quiet, obviously, when they're shooting. It was a whole different way to make films. And if you watch the Kevin Brownlow series, Hollywood, The Pioneers, which it's all on YouTube, there's a section where they talk about how when Douglas Fairbanks was making a film, he looked at the soundstage and he looked at everything that was going on, and he turned to someone and said, you know what? The romance of the motion picture ends right here.
Wow.
And so it just wasn't the same anymore. So there are quite a number of, there are some stars that just didn't make the transition. There are some that became even bigger in sound. And then there are some that, like Fairbanks, that they made a handful of them or made a few, and they just were, their heart wasn't in it. They just were over it, you know? And I think Clara had been through so much for a 25-year-old, you know? It's kind of remarkable, everything that she went through. And so, yeah, I just think she hadn't had one foot out the door and really just wanted to get those films over with and move on with her life. And so I like Hoopla, and I really like Call Her Savage. I like both of those films, actually. She's very good in them. She obviously proves she can more than handle the medium of sound. And I don't know, Hoopla kind of, it's good, but it kind of makes me sad at the end because she does look tired. She does look like she's had it, and she looks so much older than her years.
Yes, I thought that. You know? I didn't want to be like, oh, she looks bad, but she does not look like she's only 26.
Yeah, she looks like she's pushing 40 or so. I mean, not to, you know, but she looks tired. She looks older than her years. And it makes me kind of sad because I wish there would have been so much more. She was such a good actress. I mean, in a perfect world, I wish she could have transitioned into character roles and done like character performances. But like I said, I think her heart wasn't in it. She'd been through a living hell. I think she just wanted peace and quiet and family and to be left alone by the world to a large degree.
They talk about in the book that she, in the biography, that she was terrified of sound pictures, which a lot of stars were, of course, naturally. Yeah. And then, you know, did an example of like how little they thought about her treating her well is they were like, well, you got to be in sound movies. And then they put her in one movie where she had to sing.
Yeah.
And it's like, good Lord, I barely feel comfortable talking, let alone now I got to sing. And she tried to do it. It's like,
MGM took their sweet time transitioning Garbo because they knew she had a low, you know, kind of voice, that she was Swedish, that she had this accent. And they kept her from sound as long as they could. She was like the last holdout, I think, of stars that were still making silence before she transitioned to sound. But MGM took their time. They found the right vehicle, the right role. They worked with her. So by the time she made that sound debut in Anna Christie in like 1930, she became even bigger in sound than she was in silence. And Clara did not get that consideration. They just threw her in the deep end and then screamed swim, you know, basically. Mm-hmm. And that had to have been psychologically so hard to have to deal with.
Yeah, it's interesting you think about it. You mentioned like the whole vamp persona, like the Theda Bara had, and the Clara didn't do that. But in this film, it's kind of the reverse of that, in that the young guy, Chris, is this sort of young and innocent kid, and the dad doesn't want him around circus, which I love. I love that the dad runs a circus, but he realizes he doesn't want his son being around the very people that he works with, which is funny. You know, yeah. Like, oh, these are kind of low class people. This is my job, but these people aren't good enough for my son. And so the idea that the mistress, Carrie, again, hires Lou to kind of spirit him away, that the whole idea of that is that she's a vamp, and that she's, you know, kind of this slattern a little bit, and she's going to draw him into this, you know, kind of disreputable life. But she's not. I mean, yeah, she's a dancer, but she's not a bad person. And we learn, you know, she learns early on, oh, this kid's actually nice. You know, I don't want to put this, I really am falling for this kid. He's not a bad guy. And so the persona is that she's the bad one, but then you realize, no, it's not. And it's Carrie who's really the villain, because she's sort of heartless and wants to separate the Nifty from his own son, just because that means she's getting less attention. But yeah, she's really sweet. I mean, she has like this, there's like this nude bathing scene that she has, and she does a lot of like scantily clad dancing, but she's actually, again, she's really very sweet. And you do feel, I don't want to say bad for the Chris character, but he is just kind of like Candide, as he's going through, like, he has no idea what's going on around him, and he doesn't understand the plot that he's sort of fallen himself into. But she's really sweet in this movie.
Yeah, and she was so likable, you know? I mean, you just want to root for her. You want to hug her. You want things to be okay for her.
One of the things I like to do when I look for like a little audio clip to end the episode on, I love it if I can find whoever we're talking about, whatever their final line is, like in a movie, whatever their exit line is, or at least something. And unfortunately with Hoopla, like, she doesn't speak, I think, for like the last 10 minutes of the movie. Because then there's a scene with her and Chris and Nifty, but then there's all this stuff at the circus with Chris and Nifty, and then she gets brought out and she dances, but she never says anything. And I guess it's kind of, I mean, for the purposes of the show, it's not helpful, but in terms of, you know, thematically, it actually fit in that she really was a silent star, and her final visage on movies is her silence. She doesn't say anything. She's just there on screen, and the final shot is of her, but she doesn't get to say anything. So in a weird way, it sort of fit that, like, okay, she became famous as a silent star, and that's kind of how she's going out.
I mean, I actually like that that's how it ends. If you see some, there's two other examples I can think of. If you ever see the sound version of Taming of the Shrew with Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks, it was talkie number two for both of them, and they would only go on to make a total of four talkies apiece before they just left the screen. But there's a sequence in it that's got no dialogue. It's all silent, but they're in this bedroom and they've just made up after this fight, and the scene is silent. And it works so beautifully. You know, the rest of the film's kind of a little awkward, but that scene works. And then in the 1930, I think it's 33 or 34, the film Queen Christina with Greta Garbo and John Gilbert, they have some scenes too where Greta Garbo's exploring the bedroom that they're in and when they rendezvous. And that's a silent scene. Basically, there's really no dialogue, not much if I can remember, but, and sometimes when you put a silent star and they're in sound, but then you put them back in the silent milieu, if you will, it's so good. You know, it's like that magic comes back. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's, I said, I have a greater, between this, doing this episode and the one I did earlier in the year on Marion Davies, I have such a greater appreciation for the silent era than I ever have before. I really had only seen a handful of films, but now that I've seen, you know, a bunch more with these actresses, I'm like, oh, okay, this really was its own thing. I always had the toughest time with silences because I get restless a little. You mentioned seeing some on the big screen. I think that would actually be probably enormously helpful because you're just not distracted from the being at home. It's like I try to see foreign films that way, you know, where it's like it's better to let's see it in the theater. And that way I'm paying attention to what's going on and I'm not worrying about my phone or the dog or any of those kinds of things. I would love to go see some more silent films on the big screen. I just think it would help.
Oh, yeah. Well, at the San Francisco Silent, I just came back from, it's 23 silent movies in like 5 days. I managed to see 16 of them.
Wow.
Right. And a lot of them are foreign. So not only is it silent, it's foreign. I saw a Czechoslovakian silent, a Japanese silent, a German silent, a French silent. And I think silent film takes a lot more psychological concentration out of you because whenever I'm at that festival, I always feel horrendous jet lag. I feel like I've flown from LA to Nepal, only I haven't left like the Castro Theater in San Francisco. And I think sometimes seeing that many movies that require that much concentration, it kind of can make you tired. You know, it's a whole different thing. And they do have live music, great film prints. It's on a huge screen. And that's really the way those films were, of course, originally intended to be viewed and consumed. So to me, it's great to watch them on DVD or home video any way you can, but there's nothing that beats that live big screen, live music experience that truly, to me, is absolutely joyous.
Yeah, absolutely. Now I don't want to get too far off this at all, but just last night, when we were recording this, my wife and I went to go see Oppenheimer. And as we left the theater, we both very much enjoyed it and it gave me a lot to think about. But I had this weird sensation as I was driving home and I couldn't quite put my finger on it. And then it dawned on me that for the most part, when I've been going to the theater, for the longest stretch, I was seeing a lot of big blockbuster movies. And I realized, oh, I finally just saw something that's giving me something to think about as opposed to these other things, which, you know, look, they have their merits and I enjoy them, but a lot of them I don't think about for 5 seconds after I've left the theater. They're just like vapor. And I'm
in
like
one ear and out the other.
Yeah. And now I'm watching something that like is making me wrestle with thoughts in my own head about real life or things that I know have happened or history. And you're like, yeah, well, that's the way it's ideally. I mean, some things are just meant to be popcorn entertainment and that's fine, but it's also good to have that experience to sit and be shown something that makes you ponder it after you leave. I know that sounds incredibly obvious.
No, it does. Yeah.
Or, when you see a bunch of movies that don't do that and then you see one that does, you go, oh, wow. Oh, okay. Yeah.
This friend and I once were at a series of films and we saw this one film. I can't remember what it was, but we saw this one film that floored us. She and I were just absolutely devastated. And it was so good, right? And the next film after was not good at all. And I just whispered to her and I said, I can't follow up that other experience with this one. I just can't. It's like eating the most delicious gourmet meal in the world. And then someone hands you a bag of Skittles. And so now that's our code word. Anytime we're in a movie we don't like, we just turn to each other and go, Skittles. And then we're like, get up and leave, you know?
That's perfect. That's fantastic. So you know, Claire Beau packs it in after this. By the way, the two films she did, The Savage and Hoopla, were successes. They were popular, and so you know she was paid handsomely for it. But she went into it with the idea of no, I am done. This is it. So she knew when she was making Hoopla, this is it. This I'm not going to go back. And boy, did she stick to that? I mean, she moves out to Las Vegas, and unfortunately, even this relationship with Rex Bell, who was, she deeply loved this guy and he treated her well, except he decided he wanted to run for a congressional seat, I believe it was. And she was aghast at that because she's like, I don't want to be a politician's wife. I don't want the attention. As we mentioned, some of the stuff said about her in newspapers and the gossip magazines were savage. And you could see why, even at 26, she's like, I don't want this life anymore. I want to live this quiet life. And she has two sons with Rex Bell. And stunningly, he is like, yeah, I know you don't like this. And I know it's not good for your mental health, but I'm doing it anyway. It's just, you know, wow. Talk about selfish.
Exactly. It's kind of like, after everything that she'd been through, can you blame her for not ever wanting to set foot out in public again for the rest of her life?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I don't think her feelings were really taken into consideration there at all.
No. And then he ends up losing. He goes to that, and now he ends up running for other offices and he wins and stuff like that. But he really, it's so sad that she kind of went from man to man to man looking for love and not really quite being able to find it. And then presumably she does find love. And then, you know, a couple of years in, and they have children together. And then he kind of just draws this line on the sand of like, yeah, but my ambitions are more important than this relationship, even though again, it was very fractious to her mental health. And she ends up spending time in like a sanitarium and things like that, and going to see psychiatrists and getting, I think, shock therapy at one point, which is just staggering.
Electroshock therapy.
Oh my Lord. And absolutely refusing to give any interviews at all. No, zero interest. There's this detail in the book, which has made me roll my eyes, where a bunch of her films got sold to television and she never saw a dime from any of that, which is, you know, again, nothing's changed. And you know, all that money she should have earned from all her films being sold to various markets and things like that. But even when people pursued her to be interviewed about her career, she was not interested. And she seemed genuinely surprised when modern stars, at least the ones of, say, the 50s, were fans of hers. And there was this bit where Marilyn Monroe was photographed. Again, another very similar figure to Clara Bow, gets photographed for Life magazine. And she poses as Clara Bow in Life magazine. And her and Clara become pen pal friends because they saw a kinship in each other. And then she was also friends with Marlon Brando. Marlon Brando wrote this incredibly lovely note to her saying, you are like one of the best actresses I've ever seen. And I'm a huge fan. And she was tickled pink that this incandescent star of a new type of acting thought she was. And she seemed shocked that these modern stars would have any time for her. And it's charming in its own way because it's so self-effacing, but yet it's sad that you would think that, oh yeah, nobody cares about what I did. Like, oh my God, that's so tragic that you would think that.
Well, I get why they would think that though, because the minute when sound came in, a lot of silent film stars were kind of laughed at. It was considered passé. And Marlene Dietrich actually denied ever making silent film, even though she truly did in Germany. And I've seen one of them. And there was even a thing called fractured flickers where they would re-edit silent movies and speed them up and put on really wacky music and show them and laugh at them. So, and Mary Pickford wanted all of her films burned and destroyed because she thought people would laugh at them. So believe it or not, the star, you know, being ashamed and or shirking away from their career, that's not as crazy as it sounds. Cause I think a lot of them were kind of made fun of and laughed at and considered yesterday's news, in fact. So, and that had to be hard because, you know, there is a lot of truth in Sunset Boulevard. It was almost like there's a line in Sunset Boulevard. I might get it wrong here, but it said something like Norma Desmond was waving to the parade that had long passed her by, you know, and it's like a lot of those stars, they were forgotten. They were kind of just left in the dustbin of history. And there were some like Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, later in their lives, they were getting all these awards and going to film festivals and kind of being celebrated. Like those guys died knowing they were loved, knowing they would live on, their films would live on. Clara didn't get that, you know? And I was in San Francisco Silent one year and they did a screening of It. The line was all the way down the block as far as the eye could see. The entire Castro, over 1,000-something seats, sold out. People were on their feet cheering at the end of that movie. And David Sten was there. And I asked him, I said, David, wherever Clara is tonight, I so badly hope that she knows about tonight and knows what happened here. And David just said she does. So a lot of them just never got that kind of love and appreciation while they were alive. But thank goodness they're getting it now.
Yeah, like I said, when I saw the stuff about Marilyn and Marlon Brando, I was like, oh, that at least she had that. At least she saw that some of these modern stars were like, no. And there's this great detail about where there was a magazine article or newspaper article. There was something about like it was a reevaluation of the great silent stars, and Clara Bow, I think, didn't make the list because she didn't subject herself to any interviews. And so it was easier to kind of shunt her aside. And one of the people that made the list was Louise Brooks.
And she wrote a letter saying,
how dare you put me on this list if Clara's not on the list? I thought it was such a sweet gesture.
She was a sensation. Like, it's really hard to find anybody in our modern era that even holds a candle to her at her peak. And she was just such a singular personality, a singular talent. And I'm glad that at least Betty Grable also was a fan. I'm at least glad that, yeah, you're right. She did get a little bit of a sense of her own impact.
Yeah. Yeah. I was again, when I'm just doing research for this. And I mean, of course, like they did in the 90s, they did the silent film stars U.S. postage stamp series, and she's on there. Yeah. Drawn by Hirschfeld. And then the other thing I found, she is pictured, and I did not know this, she is pictured on the album cover to Prince's Around the World in a Day, and it's a cutout of her from Hoopla. It's her in her Hoopla outfit on there, then a kind of Sgt. Pepper-y kind of collage-y style. And apparently there's a song on that record that features a line about Clara Bow. So, that's great. Prince was a big fan. She didn't, you know, I mean, that was long after she had gone, but that's great that he still really appreciated her. I imagine him watching Clara Bow films up in Paisley Park or something. So
Madonna was a huge fan too.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So I think that, I just have so much affection for silent stars. I really do, because they laid the groundwork. They were laying the foundation of everything that would come after. There is no Jean Harlow without Clara Bow. No Marilyn Monroe without Jean Harlow, without Clara Bow. It's all building on each other, you know? And these people were artists. They were pioneers. They were trailblazers. And so many of them were just mistreated and forgotten. And I just have so much love in my heart for these people. I think they were just extraordinary.
Absolutely. Well, that's a good place to leave it. I think I said I have a greater appreciation for Clara Bow than I ever would have had before. Like I said, I went from having seen only one film, Wings, to seeing a bunch of her films, and I have a great understanding of her career and her life. And so I really appreciate you coming on the show to talk about this. Because I love, part of the reason I do the show is to learn about subjects that I wouldn't go probably learn on my own because I'm busy with a million other things, but I do it for this show and I love learning those things. So thank you for coming on the show and wanting to talk about the life of Clara Bow.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Oh, if you want to take a tour of Hollywood Forever, my website is cemeterytour.com. My other site is hollywoodkitchenshow.com. And I'm on Instagram as Cemetery Tour Guide.
All right. Well, my wife and I love California. We were out there for our honeymoon last year, and we love movies. We got married in a movie theater. When next time we are out there, we will absolutely have to take that tour, because that is something we would both really enjoy.
Yeah, I'd love that. You'll have a great time.
Absolutely. Yes. Sounds fantastic. So, well, again, thanks, everybody, for listening. Go check out the movies of Clara Bow. Again, you can find a vast chunk of them over on YouTube, maybe not in the greatest condition or the greatest prints in the world. Unfortunately, there aren't that many of them. I found on like Blu-ray or things like that. Silence are still, you know, most of the lost films in Hollywood history are like, what, 80% of them are silent films. But they're out there, and you can go check them out. And like I said, there's some interesting stuff there. So, again, thanks, everybody, for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of the show on our website, finewaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. We're on Twitter at FadeOutPod. And if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FWPodcasts, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on the show of your choice. So big thanks to Monique D for her support of Fade Out. I really do appreciate it. So thanks for listening. We'll be back with another Fade Out before you know it. But until then, we've reached the end of this particular script. So it's time to fade out.
Don't shoot. Don't shoot. We're one of you.
You're one of us. Apple pie. Betty Grable.
Clara Bow.
Clara Bow. Frank's right. You are old.